Berkman, Judge Larson, the Honorable Theodora Gaitas presiding.
Good morning, everyone. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are about to begin our calendar for today, October 20th, 2022. We have a number of matters on the calendar today, 5 oral arguments and 1 non-oral. It looks like we are ready to begin with our first case on the calendar, State versus J. William Snyder, A220318. And counsel, just a few words before we dive into your arguments this morning. As you know, counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes, counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal argument if you care to give one. Before you begin, because we are making an audio recording of the arguments this morning, if you could please introduce yourself and the party you represent. Additionally, if there's any other identifying information that you'd like us to know, please let us know. We want to make sure that we're addressing everyone in a manner that makes them comfortable. That concludes my remarks. Are you ready to go?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll begin with counsel for appellant. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Andrew Wilson, W-I-L-S-O-N, on behalf of Mr. Snyder. Your Honors, there were 2 issues that I had briefed in relation to Mr. Snyder's case. The first related to a continuance request. The second related to conditional release. And after reviewing the respondent's brief, I'm conceding the first issue. My argument today is going to relate entirely to the conditional release issue, which is the second issue in our brief. The point that I'd like to drive home about the conditional release issue is that the respondent has also conceded on page 10 of their brief by citing Hodges, DeWalt, and Smith that sentences of life with the opportunity of release must be prosecuted by indictment. I agree that's the case. I think that's consistent with the plain language of Rule 1701. That's supported again by Hodges, DeWalt, and Smith, all of which respondent has cited. Considering...
But are any of those cases conditional release of a lifetime term cases?
None of those are, Your Honor, but my point is that in effect, lifetime conditional release is the same thing as life with the opportunity of release. There's a prison sentence, there's an expiration of a custodial prison sentence, there's release into the community, intensive supervision, and if the supervision or the terms of release are violated, the individual may be remanded back to the custody of the Department of Corrections to serve the remainder of their sentence.
Except that at the outset of conditional release, the individual is not imprisoned, right? They're actually released into the community, unlike an individual who's serving a sentence of life imprisonment. I think that's sort of my stumbling block with your argument. Perhaps you could address that.
Your Honor, Mr. Snyder is serving a prison sentence currently. And when he is done serving that prison sentence, he will be released back into the community as if this were a minimum term of imprisonment subject to the...
The conditional release begins actually during the period of supervised release and then continues once the supervised release period is over. So how is that period when he's ultimately released into the community the equivalent of lifetime imprisonment?
Because what we're talking about is the punishment and what sentence could be imposed or what punishment could be imposed related to a conviction for this crime. And in effect, conditional release that is violated, if it's a lifetime period of conditional release, the sentence that could be executed is life in prison. It's the same thing. You can call it a different name. It's a different term. But the effect on the person who is receiving the punishment is the same. So for Mr. Snyder, regardless if he's serving a life with the opportunity of release sentence or serving lifetime conditional release, if he violates the terms once he is released into the community, he could be ordered to serve the remainder of his life in prison.
But isn't that the difference? He could be. Who knows? I mean, depending on what the violation is, there may not even be a return to custody.
And that's the same with life with the opportunity of release, Your Honor. if a person who is on supervised release after serving a minimum term of imprisonment while serving a life sentence violates, it's not automatic that they serve the remainder of their life in prison. They have to go through a DOC HRU hearing just as anyone who's released under supervised release would.
Is there any case that directly holds what you're asking this court to hold?
No, there's not, as far as I have found, Your Honor. I do believe Hodges and DeWalt support this position. I think the Stewart case that I mentioned in my brief supports this. There is, in DeWalt, a fairly comprehensive outline of how Minnesota's Rule 17.01 was developed and how it stems essentially from the constitutional guarantee of the Fifth Amendment. DeWalt cites the case Rehnquist. It also cites Apprendi and Blakely, which are all the big the United States Supreme Court cases expanding protections for criminal defendants. And I think all of those collectively infer that this court's holding would not be out of the ordinary. I think it's supported by all of those cases.
Counsel,
but no.
What about the Nodes case? What about the situation there where the opportunity to indict the defendant wasn't present because the sort of triggering event happened only at sentencing for the second offense of conviction? Just as a practical matter, I'm wondering, how that case affects your argument, how that case would affect future cases if we agree with your argument today.
Certainly, Your Honor. Two responses to that. The first is that Nodes is inapplicable here because we are dealing with a conviction that was not simultaneous. He was not tried on two criminal sexual conduct charges at once. He had a prior conviction. The more important thing, apart from that, is that contrary to what respondent claims, by issuing a holding in appellant's favor, you're not overruling Nodes. You're not even conflicting with Nodes.
But aren't you asking us to infer from DeWalt and Stewart and other cases, a ruling in support of your argument? And why can't we, in the same fashion, infer from Nodes that there is no violation? Because in that case, we end up with what happened here, a lifetime conditional release period without any indictment at the front end.
Your Honor, I believe Nodes, in conjunction with the holding that I'm requesting in this case, simply provides the state with a choice. Just like many choices that prosecutors face in how they prosecute cases, just like many choices that defendants face in how they defend against cases. And that choice is if you are dealing with concurrent criminal sexual conduct charges, the state can either try those cases together and settle for 10 years of conditional release, getting the cost, in terms of a cost-benefit analysis, the benefit is that you're trying two criminal sexual conduct cases, maybe to a jury, which is pretty weighty evidence. Alternatively, the state has the option to bifurcate and to try the first case via complaint, attain a conviction, trigger 10 years of registration, indict, try the second case, and obtain lifetime registration. Again, there are cost benefits to doing that for the state as well. So it is compatible with Nodes to hold in appellant's favor. It just simply provides the state with a choice on how to pursue their prosecution. And the state is charged with making decisions like that frequently in the criminal process. So I don't think this is that outlandish of a holding or request for a holding. The other thing I'd like to address is respondent's argument regarding custodial sentences, that the period of lifetime conditional release relates only to a custodial sentence. And I do not believe that is the case, again, because the respondent cited all of those cases about life with the opportunity of release, and a custodial sentence ends, even if it is a life sentence, upon the person's release. They are no longer in custody. They are released to the community. So I don't believe it's a question of a custodial sentence or the expiration of a custodial life sentence, because Hodges, for example, the defendant was indicted and received life with the opportunity of release after 240 months, meaning after 240 months, regardless how much time he had left to live, he's released, he's out of custody. So it's not about a custodial sentence. It's about the punishment, which is why Rule 1701 talks about punishment and what punishment is potentially, or has the potential to be imposed, rather. The concern of Rule 1701 is, could this offense be punished by a sentence of life in prison? That's the suffix able. I don't think it's ambiguous. I think it is clear. I don't think that there is any need to engage in any further statutory interpretation or interpretation of that language, because something that is punishable is permissive. It may be punished by that sentence.
Here's my question, counsel. So I think that the concept of conditional release in Minnesota is a relatively new concept. So when we're looking at interpreting the plain language of the rule, which is, I think, really the way that you've teed up this argument, in terms of trying to ascertain the intent of the plain language of the rule, if conditional release wasn't, I guess, do you know the timing of, you know, when Rule 17 was adopted versus when we first had the idea of custodial release or conditional release?
I do not, Your Honor. I can tell you that Rule 17 was referenced as early as 2008. It was referenced even earlier in 1992 in the Stewart case. So it's not new in terms I don't know, Your Honor, to answer that.
I guess a follow-up question to that would be, if indeed Rule 17 predates the conditional release requirements in Minnesota, which I think it does, why wouldn't there be some reference in the statute requiring conditional release, which has been amended a number of times, because lifetime conditional release is a relatively new thing? Why wouldn't there be some reference in that statute to the need for an indictment?
I'm not sure this issue has ever been raised to the Court of Appeals, so that's number one. I would have to check the rule, but I'm not sure that Section 244 is also referenced in the in that provision. And Section 244 is the section concerning supervised release, Your Honor. If it is, obviously that's a difficult point for me to get over, but I don't think that would be dispositive. If the Court has no further questions, I'm happy to cede the rest of my time.
Thank you for your argument. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal, one way or another. And next we will hear from counsel for a respondent. You may begin whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Dawn Nyhus, last name Nyhus, representing the respondent, State of Minnesota, this morning. Appellant began by talking about what point or points the respondent has conceded. We have not conceded anything other than what the state of the law is as to what those opinions are. However, that is not the functional equivalent of conceding what appellant's point is in terms of the statutory interpretation and the interpretation of the rule that I believe this court needs to look at. Ultimately, this court is asked to determine if the district court erred in imposing lifetime conditional release here. And in the fact that the court very clearly followed what was the statutory and rule authority, they did not err. And perhaps where respondent and appellant agree is that that is very clear within what the rule and the statute say, although we believe it's clear for different reasons. I want to begin by pointing to the criminal rule procedure of 1701, which, yes, has been in place and predated the conditional release statutes. I know it's referenced even as far back as 1999 in, I believe, the Ronquist decision, but in any event has been around for quite some time. That language is plain and clear in that it says an offense punishable by life imprisonment is prosecuted by an indictment. And I think that particular beginning of the clause is what appellant has perhaps not given the proper focus and treatment on. It is whether or not the offense is punishable by life imprisonment.
But isn't an offense that carries a mandatory lifetime term of conditional release ultimately punishable by life in prison? I mean, it's not beyond speculation that if there are enough violations of the conditional release terms that the person is looking at life lifetime punishment in a correctional facility?
Your Honor, I believe that what we would have to do in order to get there is a bit of, I guess, factual gymnastics in order to go beyond what, again, the plain language of that rule says, which is the offense is punishable. When we look at what the offense is and was charged in this case, it was criminal sexual conduct in the third degree and in the fourth degree. That offense is not punishable by a life imprisonment. It is punishable by a maximum of up to 15 years. So in that respect, the respondent would disagree in terms of having to go further into an interpretation of the language, which is not otherwise warranted.
So this is probably a stupid question, but I bet you know it off the top of your head. Are there offenses that by, you know, their nature alone, a single offense, carry lifetime conditional release?
And, Your Honor, I appreciate that the court thought I would have that off the top of my head. I don't, but what I would say and what I think the case law has kind of juxtaposed is when we're talking about things like murder, for example, there are very clear provisions on what life imprisonment is and what punishment is. What the respondent is wanting to emphasize to this court is that there are structurally and intentionally differences and distinctions in the law between what is meant by a life sentence, a life custodial punishable sentence, and what is meant by lifetime conditional release. And I think that when we look at not only Rule 1701, which is plain and clear, so is the fact that the treatment of those are very separate and distinct in 609-3455. There are several provisions in that statute, and perhaps that is where there is then the reference to the respondents' citations for DeWalt and Hodges and Smith. Those cases talk about very particular provisions of 609-3455 that are not before the court today, but deal with specifically fact finder requirements, or in DeWalt, what talked about essentially the functional equivalent of elements, and that in those respects and in those circumstances, an indictment may be something that would be necessary. Whereas, for example, the fact of a prior conviction may not be, or in this particular case, the fact that he was convicted of the criminal sexual conduct offense prior to this would not trigger the indictment. So I think that that's important to note as well. The appellant cited the Stewart decision in the brief to indicate a support for its position, but I would note also that that offense dealt with a heinous crime, heinous being, again, a specific term of art that has been used and defined in 609-3455 and, again, is a distinction here. So to the court's point, and I think it was Judge Berkman's point about whether or not there is a case on point, there's not, and I believe that is because there is a fairly clear and plain reading of both the criminal rule of procedure as well as this provision of 609-3455, and it's frankly what led to a very short record at the time of sentencing concerning support of this argument in the first place for Mr. Snyder to seek something other than a lifetime conditional release.
Can I ask what might also be a very straightforward answer? Because it does seem that you're drawing a distinction between supervised release and conditional release in order to distinguish the Hodges and DeWalt and Smith cases. I guess in Minnesota, what are the like significant differences between those types of release in terms of whether you have the possibility that you're going to have to serve a life sentence?
Well, what I can point to, Your Honor, is regarding conditional release, 609-3455 subdivision 8C talks about that even if we, and I'm of course paraphrasing, but even if we got to a circumstance where someone violated a condition of release, that it has been alleged, it has been proven, that there is still a circumstance where an individual may be revoked and sent back to prison, but not necessarily for their lifetime. So that is what I can say. It could also be something less. In terms of
is that also true with violating supervised release? So if in the Hodges case, a person doesn't serve the full life sentence, they get out after 240 months, and then they violate their term. Are they automatically going back for the remainder of their sentence, or are there similar Department of Corrections, you know, standards that would apply for how long you would be reincarcerated?
I'm not certain about the Department of Corrections standards specifically.
Okay.
In my experience, I do believe that it's certainly possible that someone could be on supervised release, have violated a aspect of that release, and then have a unit hearing, and then they are restructured. And restructured can sometimes mean, yes, that they are returning to prison for a time that might be less than the whole balance of their supervised release. That is my understanding. So I understand where the court's question lies, but I still think that in terms of the application to this case and looking at whether or not the court erred, the question is whether or not, again, this was an offense that was punishable. And I still think that carries the day over and above the rest of that analysis in terms of application. If anything, if the court were to draw a distinction, or I should say, would to draw a similarity between those two, that would seem to cut in favor of having less conditional release all around. And I don't know that that's necessarily prescribed within the statutes either. I don't believe that the fact that an individual could go back, whether it's full-time or part-time, is still the answer to the question, is this an offense that's punishable by life imprisonment?
Yeah, so I think turning back to Judge Gaitis's question. So I think one of the ways that you can get a mandatory lifetime conditional release is for the particularly egregious first offense. Would knowing that that is not this case, do you think that in those circumstances it's different, where it's one offense, you know, it fits the egregious first-time offender standard? Do you think that that changes the analysis in any way?
I think that it can, Your Honor, because, and this is just in my reading, as the court can see, I have 609.345 before me. When we're talking about egregious first-time offenders, that's subdivision 3. It also does refer back to the fact finder determining that a heinous element existed. And so I think, once again, we're looking at that additional component that's incorporated in that provision and in other provisions that's not in the provision before this court, which is that there's got to be some finding of fact, that there is a term of art that's employed, whether it's a heinous element and it's an extreme inhumane condition, for example. So, yes, I think that it may, but it doesn't apply in this circumstance.
Isn't the provision for egregious first-time offenders a provision that actually requires a mandatory life sentence and not merely a conditional release?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. And in fact, that's even indicated in the subdivision title as well. So again, another distinction between the present case, and also I think a distinction that's drawn when we see the language of how each of those provisions are structured and titled. This statute as a whole is making distinctions between mandatory life sentences and mandatory lifetime conditional release. Your Honors, I know that there were questions posed to counsel concerning NODES. Certainly, there are always cost-benefit analysis for the state to consider. However, the state does not choose, nor does a victim choose, the timing and manner in which they're assaulted. And I think that that is also a relevant inquiry here to the idea of what this decision could do to impact what NODES says. This is not simply a situation where the state might have the luxury or convenience of having timing of sexual assaults such that we could present them in the way that is suggested by appellant. That is not the reality of things. And what this request by appellant is asking is to limit and change that holding in NODES to be that we have to have that conviction. It has to have been in place in order for the state to then go forward in the next step for a grand jury under the provisions that are proposed here. That is not workable. I believe it's inconsistent with the law. I believe it's inconsistent with the reality of what we know about sexual offenses. So, Your Honors,
even if we agree with that argument, I'm reading NODES, and I've read it several times. I don't see NODES to have even addressed the issue before us today. I mean, the, you know, the procedural history and the facts are there, but there's no ruling by the Supreme Court that says a lifetime conditional release period is not subject to the Rule 17 requirement. Is there?
That's correct, Your Honor. It is not
to infer from the case.
Correct. By the court holding that unambiguously a prior sex offense conviction is one that is a separate incident entered before a second conviction, even if imposed on the same day, we're saying that is the ultimate impact of it. But that is absolutely correct. That is not the direct holding of Nodes. Your Honors, we are asking this court to find that there was no abuse of discretion in the court's decision to follow the law here. We believe the law that is clear and unambiguous, and we are asking the court to uphold the decision to impose the lifetime conditional release. If there are no further questions, I will concede the remainder of my time.
Thank you for your argument, Ms. Nyhaus.
Thank you.
And Mr. Wilson, it's back to you for a rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. 2 points on rebuttal. The first is in relation to the questions concerning conditional release versus, the conditional release scheme versus the lifetime conditional release requirement. 609.3455 subdivision 8 states that if there's a violation, the offender may be sentenced to serve the remainder of their sentence, which would be a life sentence. May. Could be less, could be more. 244.05 subdivision 3, which is the intensive supervised release statute, uses the same language. The commissioner, quote, may order the offender to serve, and the language there is the appropriate amount of time. Well, that can't exceed the maximum sentence, and the maximum sentence for someone serving lifetime supervised release, or rather a life sentence where they have been released after serving a minimum sentence, that's the same thing. So the language is slightly different between those statutes, but in effect, the outcome would be the same, that if there is a violation of the terms of their release, they may be ordered to serve the remainder of their life in prison. The second point, final point, is that I don't think that the state's perspective with how monumental this case would be if you held an appellant's favor, I don't think it would be that monumental a shift in terms of prosecution for criminal sexual conduct cases. I appreciate the perspective. I appreciate the need to prosecute those cases. But the statute of limitations is extensive when it comes to criminal sexual conduct cases. It's minimum 3 years for most offenses. Criminal sexual conduct cases are 9 years and sometimes lifetime. There's no limit for some. So I don't believe that the necessity to prosecute these cases expeditiously should be dispositive for the court's analysis. I appreciate the concern, appreciate the need to move the cases along, but that's a long time to prosecute these cases. And if, again, it's a decision that the state would have to make. Do we want to bifurcate and prosecute one and then prosecute the other, or do we want to try them at the same time? The only difference is the period of conditional release. That's the only difference. Is it 10 years or is it lifetime? It's not, are they going to receive a shorter prison sentence? Are they going to receive less felony points? Are they going to, it's nothing like that. Because if you lose at trial after losing on two criminal sexual conduct cases, the points would be Hernandized, and you receive a heightened prison sentence anyways. It could be consecutivized, stacked on top of each other. So the only difference is the state making a determination that we would like to pursue this to get 10 years of conditional release as opposed to lifetime conditional release.
I'm wondering if you could address Ms. Nyhaus's argument that if we're looking at Rule 1701, the operative word, at least I think this is the argument, is actually offense punishable by imprisonment, and the offenses that that are at issue here are not offenses punishable by lifetime imprisonment. You know, if you go to the statutes, the mandatory sentence is prescribed, and it's something short of life.
I think the court has an option to interpret an offense narrowly or broadly, and the state is requesting that you interpret it narrowly. I'm requesting you interpret it broadly. I think an offense is different than the offense, and what Ms. Nyhaus referenced was the offense. The statute says an offense, and Mr. Snyder's offense, given his prior record, is a different offense than somebody who has committed the same crime for the first time. So I believe the court would be well within its rights to issue a holding that an offense is essentially defendant-specific, context-specific. All offenses are not the same given people's records.
So then in your scenario, the state would always proceed by indictment whenever there is an offense that could be accompanied by a lifetime conditional release?
Only if the state wanted the court to ultimately impose lifetime conditional release. If the state opted to pursue both...
And the court is required to do so, right, in these cases?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the statute is clear that lifetime conditional release could be imposed if the proper method of getting there was utilized. But if the state chose not to seek an indictment, then the court would not be required to impose lifetime conditional release because it wouldn't be authorized. The court could still impose 10 years of conditional release, but its hands essentially would be tied due to the state's decision to pursue a complaint rather than an indictment. See, my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your very helpful arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.